Haven't had an opportunity yet to discuss with you joint and several liability. I do have another witness here who's prepared to, you know, talk about that.
And Kip, you're right. I'm done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Before we excuse Mr. Gronzo to have a chance to enjoy Salem and dinner this evening, are there any further questions? Representative Dix?
No questions.
Representative Phillips?
I just want to see.
Enjoyed your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gronzo. Yep.
Can I go right in then? Okay.
I think this has been our introduction.
I guess it has, yeah. I've asked Chris Kitchell down from Portland to talk on joint and several liability. I will hand out to you now what we've had put into LC draft form, the SEAL's proposed amendments to joint and several. I would simply say this about those amendments, as I think I indicated a few minutes ago, the bill that came over to you from the Senate would say that for non-economic damages, there would be several liability only. For economic damages, there would be a threshold level below which the liability would be several only. The majority report set that threshold level at below 10%. The minority report set that threshold level at below 20%. The minority report also added the provision that in apportioning fault, the jury must also take into consideration any fault of third-party defendants. With that, I'll turn it over to Mrs. Kitchell to talk on the issue.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Chris Kitchell. I'm an attorney with the law firm Stoll Reeves, Boley, Frazier, and Wise. I do primarily defense work. I am a litigator. And I've been asked to speak on the issue of joint and several liability. First of all, do you have any questions about the concept of joint and several liability or at all?
I wonder, Mr. Chair, if you could say your law firm's name five times in a row within 10 seconds.
I'll slow down.
No, I didn't mean that.
We have folks who are not attorneys here, so you might take just a moment to give us a little background information.
Okay, the idea of joint and several liability is that when you have multiple defendants, any one of the defendants is responsible for the total amount of damage done by all of the defendants. It's easiest probably explained by an example. If you have a plaintiff who's been awarded $100,000 in damages and you have two defendants and a jury finds one defendant 60% liable and the other defendant 40% liable, either one of those defendants is responsible to plaintiff for the whole $100,000 under joint and several liability. If one defendant can't pay, then the other defendant is responsible for the whole $100,000. Now, under several liability, each defendant is only liable.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Representative Hanlon.
But before a jury ever gets to that question, they must find the defendants that they apportion the fault to a cause of the damage. Isn't that correct?
Yes, joint and several liability is dealing with fault, not with causation. They would not be found at fault if there hadn't been causation. That's an essential element.
An essential element as to each and every person who the jury would not reach that question with a defendant who was not found to be a causal factor.
Yes, causation is a separate factor, separate element.
And they never get to the question if they didn't find that first.
That's right. Okay, under several liability, each defendant would be liable only for their proportionate damages. The defendant who is 60% liable would pay $60,000, the other defendant would pay $40,000, and that would be the maximum amount of their liability. That's essentially the difference.
Excuse me, Representative Dix.
And I'll let you get through this just briefly. We heard then the collateral source, 1855 was the date, and that I believe. 1855, I guess we started on collateral source. Do you have any idea when we started joint and several in this country? What was the concept of that?
Joint and several liability has been around a long time. It initially got its start in a situation where it was impossible to allocate fault. The classic example is two people fired gunshots at one person. The person dies. There's no way to tell which gun the killing bullet came from, and so the court developed the concept of joint and several liability. You both were a factor, and you therefore are both going to be jointly and several liable for the total amount of damages.
You have a year?
No, I don't.
100 years old?
Oh, 50, I think it's 25. Probably, I would be guessing, but it's, I would assume it's probably more than 100 years old, but I am guessing.
One other question is, did we come to that conclusion, you use the 60-40, because if you hadn't been, if your 40% hadn't been involved, then perhaps the incident or the liability situation might not have occurred at all?
Well, that's I guess I don't quite understand your question.
Well, I guess when I think about this, and I just started about a couple of minutes ago, it seems like when you have a 60-40 situation, and what you might be suggesting later on in your testimony is to only allow that person to pay 40% of the liability rather than the whole, if the other 60% has no way of paying, then you get stuck, but you're only 40% responsible, you get stuck for the whole $100,000. Is that because, did we come to that conclusion 100 years ago? Perhaps not in the pistols, as an example, being shot, two guns going off, but did we come to that decision or conclusion, did the courts come to that conclusion because perhaps the liability situation might not have occurred if your 40% responsibility hadn't been involved?
Now you're starting to get into issues of causation, and I think the two have to be separated. Causation, as Representative Hanlon has pointed out, is a separate issue from fault.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question on that?
Just on
the causation. In Oregon, the law is that before any defendant is held in, that the instruction is whether or not the defendant was a substantial factor in producing the conduct of the defendant was a substantial factor in producing the plaintiff's injury. Isn't that the
case? That is the law in Oregon, yes.
So there has to be a substantial factor even before the jury ever gets to the situation you might want to bring up about 1%. You got to get there first.
Right. That is one of the elements to find a defendant liable is causation.
Okay. Why don't you do it? We can pursue this. I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Okay. One of the problems we have is that we have some new policies involved. Oregon, as many states have done, has adopted a comparative fault evaluation of cases. Once you evaluate comparative fault, a lot of the old rules have been changed. We used to have defenses of contributory negligence, last clear chance, assumption of the risk, which were complete defenses to defendants to find any liability at all. Those have been essentially abolished with the adoption of the concept of comparative fault, which essentially is that you try to get the people in front of the jury that are responsible for the plaintiff's damage and then apportion the fault among those parties, including the plaintiff.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Then are you then advocating that with the abolition of the joint and several theory that we go to a concept of pure fault?
Of pure comparative fault?
Yes.
If you're asking me what my philosophy as an attorney is, I think that's correct. I think that you should have your empty chairs there. I think every defendant that is responsible potentially ought to be in front of the jury.
What that means for the rest of the committee is that she personally would advocate that we liberalize our fault concept so that even if somebody that made a claim was less than 50%, which is the law in the state now, that they could recover even if they were greater than. It would abolish the rule. I think what you're advocating is to let everyone recover for the percentage and abolish the rule that required that would foreclose somebody who a claimant who was greater than 50% as an absolute defense. Am I correct?
No, I think I might be misunderstanding you. I do not believe a plaintiff is greater than 50% liable for their own injury should be allowed to recover for damages.
Then you don't understand pure comparative.
In a pure comparative, I think we're miscommunicating. I believe that when you're trying to allocate fault, you ought to have before the court all the parties to whom fault should be allocated. A good example is the third-party practice we're talking about, that we were just talking about a little bit earlier with Mr. Gonzo, that if a third-party defendant is at fault in a particular situation, then I believe they ought to be before the court in apportioning fault among the parties who were party to the accident or injury or whatever.
Only with defendants, not plaintiffs.
Well, you're mixing apples and oranges. It's one question. It's one policy. Should we have all the parties before the court? It's the second question is how do we handle it where a plaintiff is more than 50% responsible for his or her own injuries?
Why don't we go ahead and try to continue here. We don't feel like you're being treated any differently from any other witness. This is actually a pretty mild
that's,
evening.
That's fine. Let's see. I guess the first change that's being discussed in the proposed amendments is to change the 10% threshold to a 20% threshold. And I guess perhaps one of the ways to explain is to use an anecdotal explanation. And Larry Brisby, who's a defense counsel from Hillsboro, had a case just within the last few weeks about a car accident that occurred on Highway 26 out of Portland on the Sylvan exit. And there was a person in a pickup truck. The pickup truck apparently dumped tires on the road. The plaintiff's car, which was behind the pickup, ran into the pickup and was injured. There was a third car behind the plaintiff who then ran into plaintiff. Okay. Both the car in the back and the pickup truck in the front, as well as plaintiff, were found to have causation for the accident. The pickup truck was assigned 65% comparative fault. Plaintiff was assigned 16% comparative fault. In the rear ender in the back was assigned 19% comparative fault. Under the bill as passed by the Senate, the car in the back, even though only 3% more negligent than the plaintiff, could be held responsible for 84% of the plaintiff's injuries if the pickup truck person is judgment proof. This just gets, it's essentially a degree or a question of degree of materiality, 10% versus 20%. 10% is a fairly de minimis amount of liability, and 20% on the equity seems to be just more fair. Again, if you ask my personal opinion, I would go with a straight comparative, and if it came down to having to defend that theory, I'd probably go with a straight comparative on plaintiffs also.
May I ask a question?
Lieutenant Phillips.
In that, we got three parties involved there.
Right.
Now, if Mr. Gonzo talked about third-party actions, tell me what happens when you have three independent people there that are assigned different. Would there be two different lawsuits, one against each party, or would there be one lawsuit with all three parties involved jointly?
Well, in this kind of situation, you could have had a lawsuit where the plaintiff sued the pickup truck driver in a separate lawsuit, and then the pickup truck driver then brings in as a third-party defendant the car behind. And that kind of leads into the second amendment that we're suggesting, is that in applying the provisions of this bill, that you consider the fault of the third-party defendant in the same way as you would consider a regular, as if he had been brought in as an initial defendant by the plaintiff.
I think also, Representative Phillips, in response to your question, with third-party practice, it'd be one lawsuit. It'd
yes.
all be in the same trial, and the apportionment would be made with all parties present. Without third-party practice, if one of the defendants was left out and they could not be brought in under the necessary party rule, you'd have a separate lawsuit.
But would you have a separate lawsuit by the guy in the middle or by the truck to the guy in the back?
By the guy in the truck to the guy in the back. I mean, if the guy in the middle, you know, if the guy in the middle felt that both the guy in the back and the guy in front were responsible, there's absolutely no reason why he'd file two lawsuits. He'd file one lawsuit naming them both as defendants.
Okay, thank you.
At least I can't see any reason why he'd file two suits. It'd be two filing fees, have to go through two series of discovery, he'd have to go through two trials, you know, expenses. I just couldn't see warranting it.
Well, I guess you should know my bias. I'm trying to figure out why attorneys would ever want to get rid of this third-party action, because it does seem to be you get more attorneys involved, and I have a very strong bias against attorneys, so you should know that before you come before me. And I just happen to think that anything that the members of the bar would do that would keep other members of the bar employed, they would have a bias in that way. Now, I know that's not fair for all of them, but it seems to me to run pretty true to course.
Well, I can never understand, Representative Phillips, why some plaintiffs don't name just every defendant that they possibly can. Most of them do, but, you know, why they don't, some choose not to. But, you know, quite frankly, I know in my practice, now I don't know about in Chris's, but I don't see that much third-party practice. I really don't. Most plaintiffs, if they think that they've got a smattering of defendants who are responsible, they're going to name them. I mean, it's in their interest to get any number of defendants in there who can help contribute towards the settlement.
Well, on that, if I may, on that theory, if we got rid of this this third-party issue, don't you think the good plaintiff's attorney would, as a matter of practice, name everybody to begin with?
Some don't. You just can't count on it. The good one probably would, but you know, you just don't. You can't count on it. I think the Council on Court Procedures, or a majority of them, felt, and as I say, I still think probably a majority of the members of the bar feel that it is a cost-saving device. It is. I see it more often not in personal injury cases, and unless you're really talking about a complex toxic tort litigation or products liability cases, I see it more often in contract and indemnity type actions. And there it's very useful to have.
But joint and several and third party seem to be inextricable.
They can be, yes. Okay. The joint and several under our proposals, under the proposed amendments, and third party practice are intertwined, yes.
I think that that's why the proposed Section 5 is essentially a housekeeping measure to bring third-party practice into the picture, to make sure that it's considered in the whole picture the same way as if the plaintiff had initially brought the defendant in.
Further comments?
No.
Questions?
Yeah.
Representative Phillips.
Let's get into this joint and several issue a little bit deeper. How can you, if you put a threshold of 20 or 25% or what, pick your numbers, do that with the current statute of still holding the plaintiff, the standard that the plaintiff is more at fault than the defendant, that he's not responsible? How can you mix the two? How would a judge or a jury make that determination?
The jury today is given as in those cases where you have multiple defendants and you're seeking to apportion liability, is given a fairly standard special verdict form. In fact, the Oregon State Bar Continuing Legal Education Committee has published a series of uniform jury instructions that also include special verdict forms. I'd be happy to make a copy of that special verdict form that's in effect today that is used. And that, when a jury looks at a special verdict form, it goes through a series of questions. You know, was the plaintiff negligent? If yes, you know, percentage of fault. Was defendant so-and-so? Was defendant so-and-so? And they're given blanks to fill in as to percentages of fault. And it's also set up so that if you answer one question one way, then you don't go any further through the form. In other words, if the plaintiff was more at fault than the combined fault of the defendants, you don't go any further in the form. You go down to, you know, go to number 8 or something like that.
Let me stop you there. Yeah. See, if I was a very clever defense counsel, I would say, okay, this guy's at fault to some degree, mm-hmm. and we know he's a third responsible. Well, I'll bring in as many folks as I can, portion out the other responsibility, so that somehow I bring my degree of responsibility down below that,
sure.
30%, and that sucker is then stuck. I mean, that it just seems to me to be the best way to go about it if you put in a threshold.
Well, we're saying, I think the threshold is only in addition in terms of what the ultimate responsibility is. In fact, the jury isn't going to make the decision as to whether or not a defendant is jointly or severally liable. The jury is going to do what it does today, and that is the jury is going to fill in the blanks on percentage of fault. And so the jury won't be told any differently after this than they are today.
Well, somehow the judge must make a ruling as to responsibility, and if he makes a ruling that the plaintiff is more responsible than any of the defendants, there's no...
No, the jury makes that ruling. The jury in those cases, in the special verdict form today, is asked to apportion fault among all parties. And the jury, in fact, fills in the blanks and puts in the percentages today. And that wouldn't change.
Okay. But this is, if I'm guilty of something, I should pay. However, mm-hmm. if I'm smart enough, what I want to do is get enough people around me so that I bring down the
limit, the amount that you pay.
That's
yes.
right. Uh-huh. And if I'm really clever about this, I can get out completely underneath it, because by having a threshold of some percentage, I don't care what it is, if I can bring in enough people, and obviously in not all cases will you be able to do this, because sometimes you're the person that screwed uh-huh. up, so it's your fault. But it just seems to me you would get so many people involved in the litigation, would you not? Would it not increase the participants in the process? Or?
Well, there's always that possibility. There's that possibility today. For instance, today it would be in a defendant's best interest to come up with, particularly where a plaintiff is at fault, to get his or her percentage of fault down below that of the plaintiff's, because under the law today, that defendant's responsibility is several only and not joint.
Okay, but if you add the...
I don't think you see I don't think you see an abuse of it today.
Okay.
Representative Dix,
can we get are you done with your testimony?
Yes.
Can we get back to the causation and the and try and I know it's really difficult to understand.
I don't understand the causation and joint several. Let's go back to the 60-40 equation. At some point during the court proceedings, there has been a decision by the jury, the judge, someone, that the two parties are involved, that one is 60% responsible, one is 40% responsible, meaning that, and causation means that they caused, they are to be blamed for 40% on 60% of what occurred. Is that?
No, let me interject, Representative Dix. The threshold question in the first instance, which Representative Hanlon was driving at, was, is there any responsibility at all on the part of that defendant?
Okay.
And, you know, as I think we've all agreed, that is, was the defendant's conduct a substantial factor in causing the plaintiff's injuries? Now, that could be... You could have two defendants acting in concert, causing the injury. You could have two defendants, each of whose action alone could have caused the injury. You also have joint and several situations today in the vicarious liability situation, where you have vicarious responsibility between an employer and employee, and principal and agent, and things like that. But that threshold question, first of all, is on any defendant, was that defendant's activity or action or inaction a substantial factor in causing plaintiff's injury? Okay. That is the initial, that's a threshold question. Then once you determine all of the defendants, of however many multiple defendants you have in the suit, are responsible, then the jury's asked, okay, apportion a percentage of fault among each of those defendants.
Okay, tell me where my question fits in regarding the 60-40. My concern.
Your question would fit in at the end, it seems to me. At the end, after the jury is told and is instructed, first of all, you got to find that this defendant's behavior was a substantial cause. Once you find that, then you, the jury, are instructed to come up with a percentage of fault. It would follow in that
okay,
order.
And then, but it, what, getting back to what I asked originally, go ahead. And
substantial. I'm hung up on the substantial issue. Is substantial slightly more than the guy, or is it substantial irrespective of the plaintiff's activity? Is substantial...
Yes, it is irrespective of the plaintiff's activity, yes.
Irrespective of what the plaintiff is, substantial is in some way I contributed to that action.
Caused it, yes.
I caused that action. Is, what's the word substantial mean? He mentioned 1%. I mean, if I was just having to be... when do you decide whether it's substantial or just part of it?
Representative Hanlon, do you want to interject?
I do, and I just before, and Kip can agree or disagree, but the first question that a jury looks at in that list they go down, that he says there are uniform instructions, asks the question whether or not a defendant or defendants A, B, and C, you got to, for each defendant, the jury has to come back and say, that defendant was a substantial contributing cause to this plaintiff's damage. You never get to the percentage.
No,
until
I was talking
that
percentage
question,
of of the cause part.
Yep. You never get to the fault percentage, which is what they're talking about, until that question is answered. So you never get, if the answer is no, that defendant's out.
Okay, what's the definition of substantial? And that's the part, that's the word that's got me hung up on.
But if I may interject, I think what Representative Phillips is asking, not percentage-wise in relationship to fault at all, but the question he's asking is percentage-wise in relationship to causation.
I'm afraid, Representative Phillips, we don't look at it. We don't ask juries to look at it in terms of percentage. You know, they have to find a causal relationship, in fact, between the defendant's activity and the plaintiff's injury.
The word substantial is not defined to the jury. They're told that causation, if it is a substantial factor, those are the words that are given to the jury. The jury makes the decision whether or not the defendant was substantially a factor in the causation.
And the defense attorney never goes into this process trying to decide.
Oh, yes.
I mean, somebody's got to prove whether this, my poor client wasn't substantially involved. So nobody really... It's all
argue that all the time.
I had the beholder. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hanlon.
If I can have this case for a minute. One of the cases that... To give Representative Phillips an example... case involved here, I think that this language came out of, or one of them was Simpson versus Sisters of Charity of Providence, and the case was on causation. The causation factor was whether or not the failure to take films showing a fracture on the fifth on a certain date, the 5th, and the ambulation on the 8th. In other words, they didn't take x-rays at the hospital, and then they got the guy up and walked him around, and when they should have, because they had an injury that they should have done that for, whether or not those two actions of conduct on behalf of the hospital were a substantial cause in bringing about the damage. And I think the guy ended up paraplegic. I have to read through the rest of the case. Those are the kinds of questions. They are complex. Many major trials are spent, and many dollars and effort are spent in the plaintiff proving causation to the jury and the defendant trying to disprove there was a substantial cause. I mean, that is a major factor in litigation.
If you sued me, brought action against me, and I prove that I was not a substantial contributor or causal relationship, could I then turn around and sue you for bringing me into the action in the first place?
Probably not in most instances, no.
Not unless I could prove it with...
Not unless you could...
Probably not successfully.
Not unless you could satisfy the elements of either wrongful use of civil process or abuse of process.
Okay.
I think the answer is yes, if you could show that I was reckless on what I did with no...
Or had absolutely
good
no
facts. Basis yeah. or to bring it. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there further questions? Comments? Any other business to come before the subcommittee this evening?
What did you excuse Mr. Cooney or what?
Oh, I'm sorry. Tom, did you plan
to
speak
answer
this
some
evening?
Questions? Yes.
Is anybody waiting? I was supposed to talk about
he was supposed
the
to talk. He was supposed to talk last night.
Oh.
And he was supposed to talk tonight. What I have, Mr. Chair, I've got a set of, well, two issues. I've got a set of proposed amendments on the caps. I don't know, it seems to me that that is a major issue.